I'd like to talk just for a few minutes this morning about three verses that we have in the psalm that we read just now. So it's Psalm 16 and it's verses 8 to 10, where David, he's the author of this psalm, where David writes, "I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. Therefore my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption." And as we think about these verses then, I would like to focus our thoughts around three headings or three words. And first of all, closeness. Closeness. Now, when someone is being very demanding and constantly asking us for things, we might sometimes say, perhaps affectionately, perhaps with a degree of exasperation, "You want the moon on a stick, you do." And of course, it's a fairly comical image, isn't it? The idea of kind of yanking this great entity, the moon, out of space, appending it to the end of a stick, and then plonking it in front of this tiny little human being. It's somewhat absurd and somewhat comical. And at first sight, I suppose, the opening line of our text this morning could sound a bit similar, where David says, "I have set the Lord," that is God, "always before me." Now, there's another verse in the Bible which goes something like this. It says that the heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain God. In other words, God is immense. God is bigger than the universe. God dwarfs the very cosmos itself. And again then, there's something rather strange, rather absurd about this idea in Psalm 16 of David taking this colossal being, God, and setting him always before him. Putting God, as it were, always in front of him. It kind of makes the whole moon on a stick thing actually look quite reasonable by comparison. But of course, we know, don't we, David isn't talking physically here. He isn't saying literally, physically, "I have set God in front of me." No, David means in his thinking, in his outlook, he sets God before him. In other words, God isn't remote and peripheral to David. God isn't just somewhere in the background for David. God isn't on the margins. No, God is the focal point for David's whole approach to life. Now, I'm not saying by that David is some kind of fruitcake, a fanatic who kind of renounces everything and withdraws and spends every moment of every day meditating reclusively about God. That's clearly not the case. This is a man with a deep appreciation of the natural world that comes out in so many of his psalms. This is a man with impressive musical and literary skills. This is a man who loves people, like his dear friend Jonathan and his beloved son Absalom, whose death so breaks his heart. This is a man with a rigorous work ethic, whether as a shepherd taking on the wild animals that attack his flock, or whether as a king leading his army into battle. There's nothing one-dimensional about this man. He's not a religious bore with a one-track mind. That's not what this phrase, "I have set the Lord always before me," means. But it does mean that for David, God is not just another compartment of his life. So there's the natural world, and there's music, and there's family and friends, and there's work, and then over here in another compartment, there's also God. And God is just another part of his life. And so on days when David is playing his harp, or he's hanging out with friends and family, God just has to retreat a bit and wait his turn. No, rather, God is integral to all the areas of David's life. God is integral to his engagement with the natural world, and with music, and with people, and with work. God is integral to everything in his life. For David, there are no God-free zones where God is irrelevant or unimportant or maybe left out of the equation. No, David says, I have set the Lord always before me. But there's something else we need to notice here. In the middle of verse 8, you'll see that there's the word because. And you'll also see then that in our English Bibles, the verse is divided by a semicolon. And the word because then, it relates only to the second half of the verse. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. But in the Hebrew language, you don't have things like semicolons. And I think it's quite possible and quite likely, actually, that this word because here, it's intended to work in two directions simultaneously. So yes, David is saying, because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. But he's also saying, I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. David, I think, is probably saying both of those things. Now, what does it mean then, God is at my right hand? What on earth does David mean by that? Well, again, of course, he's not talking physically and spatially. In another psalm, David says this. He says, God holds my right hand. God holds my right hand. And I think that's what he has in mind here as well. And that's a beautiful image, isn't it? You think of the mother walking through the shopping mall, the busy, crowded, noisy shopping mall with her young child. And what does she do? Well, she takes that child's hand and she holds it and she grips it tightly. Why does she do that? Well, because of her love and concern for that child. She won't allow the child to wander off somewhere. She won't allow the child to get knocked over by all the people who are walking fast in the opposite direction. She won't allow the child, worst of all, to get whisked away by somebody. It's her love and concern for the child that causes her to take the child by its hand. And David is saying here, I think, that God, as it were, holds me by my hand through life because of his love and concern for me. In other words, then, David here in verse 8 is describing a two-way relationship. Yes, he's saying, I'm constantly thinking about God. I've set the Lord always before me. But you know what? He's also saying, God is also constantly thinking about me. He is at my right hand, concerned lovingly for my safety and well-being. He puts it in another psalm, that the Lord's thoughts toward me, his thoughts about me, are too numerous for me to count. And that's what, again, he's bringing out in this idea of God being at my right hand. So there's this two-way relationship. Me constantly thinking about God, but also God constantly thinking about me. And that's the reason, then, that my first heading this morning is closeness. Because David is describing this close, two-way relationship that he has with God. And that, of course, is not something that's exclusive to David. It's not because David is a superhero of the Bible that he can talk about having this close, intimate, two-way relationship with God. This is something that's true, that is true of every Christian. Every true Christian also experiences this. Every true Christian can describe his or her life with the same two statements that David uses here. I have set the Lord always before me. I'm constantly thinking about God. He is at my right hand. He is constantly thinking about me. And this is important because I think a lot of people aren't clear on this. A lot of people misunderstand what it means to be a Christian. Perhaps you do this morning. Perhaps you think that being a Christian is just about believing in the existence of God, holding that as your intellectual position over against the atheists and the agnostics and so on. You, a Christian, believes that there's a God. Or then again, perhaps you think that being a Christian is about worshipping God at a weekly church service. Now, of course, both of those are important matters for every Christian. Believing in the existence of God, worshipping God with his people on the Lord's Day. But it's much, much more than that. Being a Christian is being in this close, two-way relationship with God that's daily and dominant in your life. I wonder, is that true of you this morning? Are you a Christian in those terms, on that definition? Do you know this close relationship with God? So that's the first thing in our passage, closeness. Second heading this morning, confidence. Confidence. Because that second half then of verse 8 really is a remarkable expression of confidence, isn't it? Where David says, because he is at my right hand, because God is holding my hand, because he's so lovingly concerned for my safety and my well-being, because of that, I shall not be shaken. Now, we use this language of being shaken quite often, don't we? And we use it about something that affects us emotionally. So we might say then that I was shaken by those events that took place in Kenya this past week. We might use the language in that way. And what we mean, of course, is that we were filled with shock and with horror and with consternation. It affected us emotionally. That's not really what David means here. He's not here claiming that he's never shaken in that emotional sense. You only have to read David's Psalms to appreciate that he was pretty regularly shaken in an emotional sense. Few people in history have testified so powerfully and so poignantly as David does in his Psalms to his emotional roller coaster ride. So he's not claiming then that I'm never shaken in that sense. David's talking about something else here. Some of you in this room will remember Nora Grant. And Nora then was one of the founding members of this church. And for many years, Nora lived in a high-rise block of flats in Shieldfield. She lived at the heady heights of the 22nd floor there in Shieldfield House. And I recall then, as perhaps some of you do, I recall being in her flat in fairly strong winds and feeling the building swaying slightly. And I guess at first it was a little bit unnerving, but it wasn't anything that you got kind of desperately worried about, because at the end of the day you knew it was a strong building, it was a robust structure, there was little chance of it being flattened by some strong Newcastle winds. I recall other occasions when I've been in a tent in strong winds. And the tent then, like Sheolfil House, has been shaken. It's swayed. But there in the tent, I have felt somewhat unnerved. Because, of course, it's a fairly fragile structure. It's not made of bricks. There are no deep foundations. It's held up by a few poles and pegs and ropes. And a shaking then, for a tent, can be fatal. A shaking for a tent can mean disaster. A shaking for a tent can mean total collapse. And that's the kind of shaking that David has in mind here. When he says, I shall not be shaken, he means I shall not be shaken to the point of total collapse. He's not saying I won't be emotionally shaken. He's saying I shall not be flattened. I shall not be finished. I shall not be shaken irreparably. That's what he's saying. Yes, I know life is tough, he would say. I know that there are many winds, there are many gusts, there are many storms that we face in this life. And I face many of them, he would say. The storm of being pursued by a jealous king who wants to kill me. The storm of being betrayed by those closest to me. The storm of losing a child in infancy. The storm of presiding over a deeply and increasingly divided family. I've experienced all of those, he would say. And yes, they're tough and they're extremely unpleasant. But I know this. There is no storm that can shake me out of the ground, as it were. There is no storm that can flatten me altogether. There is no storm that can finish me off, because God is at my right hand, because he's holding my hand, because he's with me, because he's so concerned for me. There's no storm that can finish me off altogether. And so, as I say, it's a remarkable expression of confidence, isn't it, on David's part? But you might say, well, actually, to call it confidence is being rather generous. Surely this isn't confidence. This is out-and-out naivety on David's part. This is sheer reality evasion by David. This is nonsense. The man's living in cloud cuckoo land. Doesn't he know that there's one storm that will shake him all right? Doesn't he know that there's one storm that will finish him off? That storm that we call death. Yes, God might be at his right hand, but that won't stop him dying. He'll still end up a motionless corpse in a grave somewhere, a mere name on a headstone. Doesn't he know that? Doesn't he know that he's mortal? How can he say here, I shall not be shaken? Well, this is where we need to move on to verses 9 and 10. Because in those verses it becomes clear that David does know about that storm. He knows about the great storm of death. He knows about his mortality. But here then in verses 9 and 10, he addresses that. And the way in which he does so is quite breathtaking. He says in those verses that even that storm, even the storm of death, will not finish him off. In verse 10, he talks about Sheol. Now, Sheol is a word that we encounter quite often in the Old Testament. It's basically a poetic word for death. Where we have Sheol here, you could just read death. And David says then, there in the first half of verse 10, he says that, yes, I will go into Sheol. I will go into death. I will die. That storm will hit me. I know it will. I will go into Sheol, but, he says, because God is at my right hand, because he's so lovingly concerned for my well-being and safety, I will not go even into Sheol for good. I will not go into death forever. I won't be abandoned there, he says. I won't just be left there to stay in death forever and ever and ever and ever. No, yes, I will go into it. But the God who holds my hand, David says, will also bring me back out again. That's the remarkable claim David is making. Now, he's not here alluding vaguely to some mystical kind of afterlife. Because look at what he says in verse 9. In verse 9, he says, therefore, so because of this, because God is at my right hand, and even death cannot flatten me, my heart is glad. Now, he's not here just talking about, he's not talking about the organ that pumps blood around the body. The heart in Hebrew thought is the inner self, if you like. It's the seat of our intellect and our emotions. The inner self, that's what he's referring to there. And he says then that my heart is glad because it is not going to be abandoned then in death. It's not going to be left in death. God will restore my heart. He will rescue my inner self. But then look at how he continues in the second half, verse 9. My flesh also dwells secure. That's his body he's talking about there. His physical body. And he's saying then that it too will not be abandoned forever in death. It too will be rescued by the one who holds my hand. It too will be brought back out. In other words, David here is alluding to nothing less than full-blown bodily resurrection. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about some indefinable part of him surviving death. He's talking about his whole person, soul and body, one day being rescued by the God who holds him by his hand. And again, this isn't something then that's exclusive to David, because he's David. This is something that is shared by every true Christian. Every true Christian is in this close relationship with God, we're saying. But now we're also saying every true Christian, because of that relationship with God, can contemplate the great storm of death itself, knowing that it's not the end, and rejoicing that the God who holds us by our hand will rescue us from that realm. Closeness, confidence. Third heading this morning, Christ. Christ. As we close, I want to address two possible flaws then, two potential flaws in everything I've been saying so far, two potential objections to everything that we've just been talking about. So objection number one then, surely this whole idea of looking forward to resurrection, surely it's all rather primitive. And yes, we can understand David thinking in those terms. David lived in a pre-scientific age. David lived in an age where everyone believed all kinds of funny things like that. But to say that we, as Christians today, that we can be contemplating the same thing, that we can have this same prospect, surely that's a bit crass and a bit naive. Well, this is where we need to look again at our text, and particularly the last part of it then that we haven't yet commented on, the second half of verse 10. And on the face of things, David seems to be just repeating himself. So he said in the first half, you will not abandon my soul. Actually, my soul is better, my life, or just me. You will not abandon me to Sheol. And then he repeats himself, surely, or let your Holy One see corruption. I don't think actually he is just repeating himself here. I think that in the second half of verse 10, David actually suddenly shifts to a different person. He's talking about somebody else. And it's not arbitrary to suggest that. It's striking that throughout this psalm, David has constantly used the word my. This psalm is full of my's. So verse 5, the Lord is my chosen portion, my cup, you hold my lot. Jump to verse 7, talks about my heart. Verse 8, my right hand. Verse 9, my heart, my whole being, my flesh. Verse 10, my soul. And then suddenly, second half, verse 10, not or let me see corruption, or my body see corruption, but let your Holy One. Suddenly, it's not my. He's talking about another. And notice too, that he's talking about something even more radical here. Now, it's pretty radical to be talking about resurrection at all and our whole person being rescued from the realm of death. But here he's talking about something even more radical. He says about this person that they won't even see corruption. In other words, it's not just that they will be rescued from death someday in the future, having been in the realm of death for centuries and millennia perhaps, but that this person will be rescued from death so soon after dying that his body won't even have begun to decompose. Clearly, the Apostle Peter was correct, wasn't he, when preaching to thousands of people on the day of Pentecost, recorded for us in Acts chapter 2, he quoted these verses. And he said David was prophesying in this bit about Jesus. At the end of verse 10 there, it's no longer David that's in view. It's Jesus that's in view. Because he went into the realm of death. And he was rescued by God. But he was rescued not centuries later. He was rescued 3 days later. So that his body didn't even see corruption. And what's the significance of that then? Well, the significance of that is that for us, reading this psalm today in 2015, it doesn't entirely have a future orientation as it did for David and his first readers. For us now, we can see some of what David is talking about already having been fulfilled, already having happened. Jesus has been raised. The last part of our text has already come true. Is it so primitive? Is it so crass to believe then that it could come true for us as well? We have these wonderfully credible eyewitness accounts in the New Testament documents of people who saw Jesus risen from the dead and were so convinced that they had seen Jesus risen from the dead, they would lay down their lives for that testimony. They would die rather than deny that testimony. The evidence for Jesus' resurrection is as good as the evidence for any event in the whole of history. Jesus rose in fulfillment of this psalm. And so it's perfectly reasonable, if you're a Christian this morning, to say, well, through trusting in Jesus, God will raise me also in the way that David describes. So that's one objection. But then the other potential objection to what we've been saying is this. This whole business then of being in a close relationship with God, which we're saying is basically the bedrock of this whole text. That's where we began. That's the thing that everything else here is founded upon. This whole concept, how is it possible? How is it possible to be in a close relationship with God when the Bible everywhere tells us that God is infinitely pure? morally perfect. And yet we clearly are not. None of us is. If we're honest, all of us are morally flawed, aren't we? We lie, we gossip. We put ourselves before just about everything and everyone else. We're flawed and twisted and rotten in our hearts. How then is it possible for us to be in this close two-way relationship with God that we began with this morning? Actually, it's a problem, it's an issue that David himself felt acutely. As you all know, David himself was a sinner. David was morally flawed. And that erupted in one particular incident in a very graphic way, when he slept with somebody else's wife and then, trying to cover what he'd done, murdered the woman's husband or arranged for his death. And conscience-stricken after that episode in his life, David interestingly wrote a psalm, Psalm 51, and in that psalm he used a phrase identical to the one we have in verse 8 here. But instead of "I have set the Lord always before me," he said, "My sin is always before me." Exact same words he uses, but of sin. Sin always before me. I can't stop thinking about my sin. It's so gross what I've done. It's so disgusting. It's so depraved. It was just plaguing this man. And so it's an issue then for us all this morning. If we are so vile, so twisted, so rotten, God is so pure, how can we be in a close relationship with him? Well, we can answer that if we answer one more question. And the question is this. Jesus, we've said, is the fulfillment of the last part of our text, the last part of verse 10. Jesus rose from the dead. That's what we've been thinking about throughout our service this morning. Why was Jesus dead in the first place? He's called here the Your Holy One. Jesus was special, wasn't he? He wasn't just another man. He was the Son of God who had come down to earth and taken our humanity. He was special. Why on earth had he died? What was he doing in the realm of death to begin with? Well, the answer is, he died on that cross on Good Friday to take the punishment for our moral flaws, our moral depravity, so that if we trust in him, instead of being punished by God, which is what we deserve, instead we can be brought into this close, intimate, two-way relationship with him. It's the only way it's possible. We can't have a relationship with a pure God without Jesus dying on the cross. But he has died on the cross. And so my final challenge to you this morning is, are you trusting in the death of Jesus as the answer to your sin, your guilt, and as the gateway into a close relationship with God? A relationship so close and beautiful that God holds you by your hand, as it were, as you go through life, and will even one day rescue you from the grave. It's a great thing to be a Christian. It's a great thing to be able to read these words and appropriate them and apply them to yourself. This morning, you can place your trust in Jesus Christ, and I urge you, as many others in this room would do so also, I urge you to do that. Amen.